Hey everyone, welcome back to another Meet Kevin Report. It is episode number 113, and we are now looking today at some catalyst called GDP, annualized quarter-over-quarter read. It is what keeps you out of recession. Well, technically at least, given that we did have a negative GDP two quarters in a row. In fact, I was just reminded yesterday that we found out that we were in a recession last year, that is my family and the team, when we were on the Eurostar last year, going from Paris to England, to London. And then all of a sudden, there comes the headline, the U.S. officially in technical recession. Kind of wild. That was the Q1, Q2 negative GDP read. Right now, we're expecting that GDP annualized growth rate. So basically, they take one quarter of the year, and they multiply by four. We expect that number to be 1.4%. We'll also get a little bit on personal consumption, expecting to come in at 3.8. GDP price index looking at 4.2, and a core PCE quarter over quarter looking at 5%. So hopefully we get some strong GDP and soft inflation data, and that'll come out within the next 37-ish minutes here. And then, of course, in about 24 hours plus about 12, we will be raising the prices on all those courses on building your wealth, especially since we've got amazing lectures coming this weekend, probably around Sunday later in the day, before we go live again on Monday. So check out all those programs linked down below in Building Your Wealth, as we will be having another release totally for free for all existing members. And I was reminded the other day, we still have members from 2017, 2018, and they're just constantly getting new lectures. So join the group. Anywho, we'll also be getting initial jobless claims and continuing claims today in about 37 minutes now. We're looking for initial claims of 265, continuing claims at 1.765 millis. As far as the market, it's actually looking green as we've kind of gotten J-Pow behind us. Yesterday, you had a little bit of a J-Pow catalyst. And that J-Pow catalyst, other than him suggesting that, hey, we might be facing two or more hikes, honestly, it seemed like the market cheered that J-Pow wasn't solely trying to reduce stock prices. That wasn't his sole mission. Sorry, excuse me for a sec. Still got that lingering curve. It's kind of annoying. Anywho, NVIDIA did respond to the information about these new potential AI chip export controls. Somehow, even though NVIDIA sells around 20% of their goods to China, 20-25%, and somehow, when servers make up about half of that, and we know the A800 is part of that, somehow, NVIDIA suggests that their revenue isn't actually expected to be impacted. So I don't know if that's just because maybe that's like a hint that things are going so well for the company that even if they lost 20% of China, all their EPS numbers are just going to blow out anyway. But it sounds good, which is quite interesting. Anyway, then obviously we have the bank stress tests from the Federal Reserve. We'll be going through some of that a little bit later here in the stream. Then we'll also evaluate a little bit more on the economy and what some of the banks and Wall Street are suggesting in terms of what's actually going on out there. I think that'll come conveniently right after the bank stress test, and right along the GDP numbers that we'll be getting. So we'll be looking forward to those. So someone here asks, hey, Kevin, are you still not seeing anything that would make you nervous about stocks? No. You know, I try to look at what are the most bearish things out there, and I'm thinking inverted yield curve, which... It's dangerous to explain things away, but I mean, it makes sense if inflation is where it is that the yield curve would be inverted. I mean, if inflation is 5%, why would you, and it's expected to be 5% for a 2-year period, why would you take a yield lower than that? You know, if you were to buy treasuries, and I don't suspect you would. So to some extent, that makes sense that the inflation we're seeing is driving the yield curve. These fears about an earnings recession continue to get revised away. We continue to see increases to earnings forecasts rather than decreases. You know, yesterday I was going through some of the information that we talked about back in January of 2022, and there everyone was worried about negative earnings revisions. A lot of people were saying, oh, it's just going to be one quarter. It ended up being like a year. And now there's the question here, would NVIDIA be honest? Well, I think they have to be, otherwise they set themselves up for lawsuits, right? Now it's possible these Chinese sales could hurt them, but maybe they're making it up somewhere else, right? Anyway, all right, so let's see what we got here. We got this beautiful piece from Barclays that I want to go through. And it's a little bit of a transition from the bank. We enjoyed this piece, so we'll go through this in just a moment as it pulls up. You do have the 10-year Treasury still sitting at 3.75. You've got oil, WTI, sitting at 69.78. Brent, international blend, sitting at 74.30. Pre-market's actually looking not that bad. Yeah, Tesla up 1.6%. You've got, what else do we have here? NASDAQ up 32 bips. Snowflake up another 1.29. Intuit 46. You've got, let's see here. Intel, 74 bips. UI has been, UI doesn't trade much in the pre-market. It's been stuck in the mud a little bit around the 170s. Oh, man. Anyway, all right. So, let's get into this Barclays piece and see what they have to say. Because they give us a little bit of look into flows as well. All right, stand by. Do you think Enphase has a competitive advantage over SolarEdge? They are very similar. Yeah, I'd say the Enphase microinverters are probably significantly higher quality. And SolarEdge it used to be used by Tesla, the inverters. Until they got dumped. Yeah, poor SolarEdge. That doesn't make SolarEdge a bad company. But yeah, they're similar competitors to some extent. I think there's a lot of juicy overlap. So, okay. All right, here we go. I'm going to pull this one. Oh, I may as well pull Morgan Stanley with it. Okay. Good. So, let's get started here before we get some of that good old data. All right. Bears to bulls. Okay. So what's going on with the big banks like Barclays and Morgan Stanley? And not the Mike Wilson bear. We already know he's a bear over at Morgan Stanley. What are the primary researchers at the institution suggesting? Well, here's the latest from Barclays, and then we'll get into Morgan Stanley. They have different looks at the current economy, but take a look at this. FOMO, folks. FOMO has seen frustrated bears turning into reluctant bulls. You know, this reminds me of just a week or so ago, we covered a T.S. Lombard piece where T.S. Lombard said, look, we're bears, but we're buying because stocks are going up. And I thought that was rich. I'm like, wait, what? You're positioning into stocks even though you're bearish because stocks are going up and you're afraid they're going to go up even more? Like, if I said that on YouTube, I'd get chastised. Like, I already get chastised if I just say what I'm going to do and I'm fully transparent about it. But to say, I'm a bear, but I'm going to go long, blows my mind if people say that. But that's true. That's what's been happening. And so Barclays is picking up on this. And so they're talking about position normalizing and risk basically spreading out. Throughout stocks within the U.S. economy, especially to some extent in the U.S., mostly in the U.S., whereas in the EU and the U.K., you still have a lot more defensive positioning. So what does that mean? Well, let's look into this. Most investor types have bought equities over the last month. Mutual fund equity inflows were the highest level in June since February, as private money moved to neutralize some of their long-standing underweight. So in other words, you've got this, remember the Bank of America survey where we had somewhere around, 32% underweight from fund managers for equities? Well, you're starting to get that flip-flop. That's finally starting to happen. And here, you see low volatility has allowed certain systemic strategies to continue re-risking and hedge fund betas to equities nudge up. Okay, in English, basically, hey, look, volatility is so low, you could still buy your bearish puts, but just go long equities as well. And that's somewhat what we're starting to see happen on top of this AI frenzy bringing in retail investors. And listen to this, who had stayed on the sidelines for most of the year. Depressing. It always seems like that's how folks miss some of the best returns of the market, is by waiting for like a royal invitation to get back in. Getting back in is the hard part. You either get in too early or you get in too late. It's very difficult to be perfect on, out perfectly and in perfectly. Anyway, amongst all this, we note short equity future positions have been trimmed, adding to the sense of degrossing slash going back up towards benchmark equity weight. In other words, balancing out, going back to, all right, we got to have stocks at a normal position in our portfolio. All right, what else do we have about cash here? Hold on one sec. Sorry, I've still got this nagging cough and cold, but don't worry, it's not going to stop that beautiful, sexy lecture release this weekend, or that price going up tomorrow night for all the programs on building your wealth, whether it's the Zero to Millionaire Real Estate Investing, the Stocks and Psychology of Money, or the Income, How to Make More Money and Get SH9T Done Faster course featuring AI. Really good lectures, by the way. A lot of good compliments coming out of that one. So what do we have here? Despite the latest buying spree in equity, overall positioning is balanced at best. See, a lot of folks, and I see this regularly, anytime you have this crash in a market, and then you have a little bit of a recovery, the first thing the bears do is say, oh, it's just the bear market rally. Like, this is just the beginning before we leg down again. The problem is, that's how they end up having an excuse to stay on the sidelines. Well, the issue then is when we continue to actually go up, their excuse starts weighing down, and you start going, all right, so like, how are you going to position now? Well, apparently, most new money is still going into cash and bonds. Listen to this. X asset flows, which basically means, where's the money going, are mostly new money, or is mostly being directed to the bond market and money market. So let that sink in for a moment. If somebody comes upon new money, so, they sell a house, let's say, and they've got 200 grand, from equity from selling their home. Where is most of that money? Well, more than 50% of it is still going into cash via bonds or money markets. This is a way of suggesting that you're nowhere close to the days of Tina, where everybody's like, throw everything you have into the stock market, and you got the euphoria of November of 2021. You're nowhere close to that because of positioning today, which is actually bullish. That's fantastic. Anywho, positive EPS revisions have provided fundamental support to equity inflows, but stand in contrast to mixed economic or activity data. Therefore, the upcoming earnings season may be make it or break it for stocks. We've talked about this as well, that you would expect some pre-positioning going into this Q2 earnings season. And I think that's why we've seen some volatility over the last few days, where we've had quite a few red days, and by quite a few red days, I mean like four, because of not only some end of the quarter rebalancing, but also hedging going into earnings. All right, fine. What else? Tech is driving regional equity flows. All right, well, we kind of knew that. That's U.S. investors, however, are starting to sell their European equities for the first time this year. Now, this I found interesting. I've been saying, probably for just, quite frankly, a few years now, get me out of emerging markets. I don't want emerging markets. I don't want the S&P 500. I want tech, chips, and innovation. I don't care about the rest of the world going through this crisis, I think the U.S. is going to weather it the best. And you're finally actually getting rotation from U.S. investors dumping their foreign crap and getting more properly positioned in U.S. stocks. Good. And that's probably because Europe is feared to actually go into the recession or a recession, whereas the U.S. may dodge it. Outflows from U.K. stocks continue unabated amid renewed stagflation worries. Yeah, especially with that spike in inflation over there. Japan continues to see strong inflows. I'm not sure why, but anywho. Tech inflows masked uneven sector trend. Positioning on banks cut sharply. Global flows have been going predominantly into tech, but active manager performance in Europe have taken a hit as value/cyclicals have fared better in Europe. So in other words, for Europe, value stocks. America, tech, baby. Tech exposure has quickly moved to above average for hedge funds. That's true, but not yet for your typical investment advisors. Keep in mind, that's different from a hedge fund. A hedge fund, pretty much anybody can make a hedge fund. You don't have to be licensed to create a hedge fund. Hedge fund is just sort of like, yo, I got fun. Accredited investors, give me your money and I'll trade with it. That's basically a hedge fund. That's different from like an ETF where you position into specific stocks with a specific predetermined strategy that's transparent. And it's different from a financial advisor actually sitting down with somebody personally and giving them financial advice. I've never done that. You know, even though I'm a licensed financial advisor, I got my license for my ETF. But anyway, so what else do we have here? Lower equity volatility may persist through the summer. Fine. All right. Boring. Some of this is somewhat insightful, though. Okay. Frustrated bears have become reluctant bulls. Over the last month, mutual funds resumed buying equities for the first time since February. Now, that's a big deal. Mutual funds buying. That's great. A lot of the folks with money, they still put money in the mutual funds. I don't know why. I don't know why you put your money into a mutual fund instead of an ETF. I literally cannot find a single reason why you would do that. But people still do. And the fees are a lot higher. It's, anyway, the tax benefits aren't as great. Talk to a CPA. Anyway, the bigger year-to-date picture is unchanged, with most it flows going to safe assets. And the flows to equities may prove fleeting. And they always say that. Anyway, last week, equity flows turned negative again on hawkish central bank talk and weak data. But it's noteworthy that equities were being bought despite the negative economic data. Yep, that is a style of going risk on. All right, great. What else? So here's the bull bear index, mostly positive now since the start of 2022, or the most positive since the start of 2022. You can see here at the end of 2021, you really got this big decline, and that really started moving up again at the beginning of 2023. Fantastic. Okay, so we've got Morgan Stanley to look at in just a moment as well, but I like looking at this here. High-frequency data like retail call option buying has moved up sharply to the highest level in more than a year. I generally prefer buying shares just because, remember, with timing the market, when you're doing options, you're really timing it two times, if not three times, because you're timing the buy, and then you're determining how long to hold, and then you're determining close, and then do you roll the option or do you go to shares? There's a lot that could go wrong. Whereas if you just buy shares and the stock goes up, boy, it's a lot less stressful. And you know, selling calls in a Nike swoosh environment is risky. Although some people look and go, hey, you know, made good money this year so far, why not? Fair, fine. But then again, you know, the crazy thing is, the year has almost perfectly aligned with when we started seeing the Nike swoosh. I don't know that anybody really expected that. I know we expected the tax loss harvesting in December and then rebuying in Jan. But the fact that we pretty much Nike swoosh starting Jan 1, pretty wild. So, of course, you're going to have outsized gains year to date for 2023, but most people didn't buy all their junk, you know, in the first trading day of January. Anywho, so what do we have here? Option volumes high, demand picking up again, great. Rising optimism on stocks amongst retail. Okay. Cash bonds remain king. Yep, talked about that already. All right, so we're going to go over to Morgan Stanley. We'd like to take a look at Morgan Stanley. So, Morgan Stanley. Oh, Morgan. What have you to say? So, Morgan Stanley, this was a little wild. Ready for this? New work on the labor market now supports a soft landing. You know, I'm trying to find bearish pieces, but even the bears are starting to sound bullish. Kind of interesting. So, what do you got over here? You got, we see wage growth slowing into 2024, but identify five key factors that should keep the unemployment rate low, underpinning our call for a soft landing. All right, let's get into the five factors in detail. So, hard landings are recession. Our call for a soft landing is underpinned by a market, a labor market, that slows but remains resilient as companies in certain sectors continue to backfill positions as well as retain existing workers. Now, this is interesting. So consider this idea of a backfilling. And what Morgan Stanley is going to do is they're going to evaluate, as well as what other institutions have been doing, is they're evaluating this idea that a lot of people have at their jobs potentially been overworked since the pandemic, just because it's been so hard to get your hands on this actual proper amount of labor. And so what they've done, companies done in general, is if they just overwork their existing workers, and backfilling is a way of saying, okay, let's take some of that stress off and start pulling back a little bit to where we're saying, all right, let's distribute this evenly. And that really, that type of backfilling supports continued hiring. So that way you're not putting as much stress on your existing workers anymore. There's actually another piece by UniCredit. UniCredit right here is a piece, we broke this down. This was just from a couple days ago here. But take a look at this segment right here. There are many factors that could explain the slow response of the labor market to the Fed's tightening cycle. Well, we know we've gone up 500 basis points, so why is the labor market doing so well? First, the full effect of a monetary policy change on output is usually transmitted with a lag. We know that unemployment tends to be lagging. So in other words, that we're still gaining significantly into what we've gone to a pretty tight or restrictive macro environment led by the Fed. Second, unusually high savings stock built up during the pandemic has allowed households to keep spending. Now, we've heard this before. People have more money, with the exception of those in the lower maybe 40% of incomes. They've already spent their money. But those higher levels are continuing to spend, and that's supporting earnings growth at companies. Or even if it's not earnings growth, at least it's supporting earnings flatness. But that earnings flatness is allowing companies to retain their talent. Third, still high profitability of firms. Right, well, that combines with spending, right? You need revenue, and the profitability is margin. You're not having to squeeze margins so low yet that you're saying, look, just to survive, we need to start laying people off. You haven't gotten to that point yet. I really think some of the layoffs that we've seen at big tech have been what I call opportunistic layoffs. Opportunistic layoffs are kind of where you're like, dude, we've gotten bloated. We've hired too many people. Half of these people don't even show up for work. They're not productive. They don't care. They're just collecting a paycheck. If we fire them, we're going to get sued. But if we lay them off because of an economic recession, then they won't sue us. I honestly think a lot of that goes on. Anyway, and then finally, the service sector, which is driving the phase of the recovery, is a sector that favors a shift from spending goods, you know, obviously to services, whatever, is still expanding. And so you've got these five elements that are why you're seeing this labor hoarding. And I thought this piece was perfect to combine with the Morgan Stanley piece right here, Wait for that right here to load. There we go. Because that's what they're talking about. This labor hoarding. And now Morgan Stanley phrases this slightly differently. They suggest that the economy is still understaffed. And this is what that backfilling means, where you're saying, look, we're still overworking people. And we get another person in, now we can get into a little bit more of labor balance at our companies. And really, a lot of companies don't want to lay off the good workers just for the sake of a little bit of a margin boost. Because when the economy starts booming again, it's going to be hard to find those people again. So it'd be better to get through the tough time with less revenue or maybe flat net income or whatever, but at least get through with great people who are going to do fantastic work going into the next cycle. So that was fascinating from Morgan Stanley as well as UniCredit. So that's a little bit on hiring. But what else do we have here? When it comes to productivity, Morgan Stanley made this interesting argument about GDP, looking at GDP data per worker. And that's how they were identifying that people are still being overworked. And that maybe by hiring more, you're actually just bringing this into a balance. And that's why you're potentially continuing to see this hiring. What else? We also note this here. Past cycles indicate that state and local jobs tend to recover more slowly than private sector employment, mainly due to revenue shortfalls causing budget pressures and the inability to keep up with private wages. So really, it's a way of saying that when the economy starts booming, the private sector gets all the jobs because the government doesn't have as much money to pay competitive prices. And in a few recessions, local government workers actually end up losing jobs because even local governments get squeezed. But that's more like your 1981 and 2008 recessions. Knock on wood, you don't see that today. That would be bad when you start seeing that public sector laying off people. However, as the private sector slows down and they finish their backfilling, now the government can actually step in and start hiring people because there's less competition for people. So this is kind of wild. I hadn't heard this argument before, but take a moment here and think about that for a moment. One second. I'm so sorry. This cough is just absolutely killing me. But every time I take like a brief little pause, just think that when I'm coughing, I'm going, coupon code expires tomorrow. All right. So I hadn't thought about this before, but I think it's such an interesting perspective that, okay, so private sector hiring goes down and then you kind of go low and then it's almost like you hit like a clown bell. Ding. Oh, now governments can hire. Government hiring goes up. And so the overall level of hiring actually stays elevated. That's actually kind of incredible. That's fascinating. All right, let's keep going here. So let's see. Okay, that's the labor hoarding segment. What else do we have here? Morgan Stanley suggests that they do not see unemployment getting close to 6%. They don't see it. They think that unemployment may increase slightly, but nothing close to the levels of 6%. The prediction of 6% assumes the post-COVID relationship between postings and unemployment seen from 2020 to April 2022 remains valid. We argue that the shape or position of the curves that they refer to, may change over time and point to the fact that recent data prints seem to be moving along a different path. Now, they use these fancy charts here, like the Beaver Ridge curve, which on one side plots the vacancy rate, on the other side plots the unemployment rate. And the idea is that usually the lower the vacancy rate, the higher the unemployment percentage. But as is usually a problem with history is that every cycle has elements that are different. And so now they're charting a soft landing. They're like, wait a minute, we have a higher vacancy and a lower unemployment rate. This is interesting. So, you know, things slightly different than you would have otherwise expected. In addition to that, they expect higher labor force participation will come out and we'll continue to see labor force participation actually grow over the next few months. Now, there were some banks that I don't have a full piece on from them, but there were some banks talking about how they expect unemployment claims and the jobs creation level to finally actually start showing negative negative reads starting in about September, October, which is actually coming up. We're already basically in July, which is crazy. That means we're already done with half of the year. That's pretty remarkable. But anywho, so here is also an exercise where they come to this conclusion and say, in a more recent example, a positive 100 basis point shock to wages only raises inflation by 10 basis points. Now, this was another shocker to me because history tells us that a wage price spiral occurs when wages rise, prices rise. But this cycle, I don't like to use the phrase this time is different, but this cycle has so far been different in that this hasn't so far really been a wage-driven inflation. It was a money printing and supply chain-driven inflation disaster. And so now you've got Morgan Stanley estimating that even if we see wages rise by 1%, we actually expect inflation to only go up 1/10 of that. That's insane. 10 basis points. So in other words, to get a full percent of inflation, you would have to see wages go up 10%. That's insane. They call this the fall in the inflationary pass-through, representing a substantial reduction in the dynamic effect of wages, which is something that history would be like, no. But the recent data is showing exactly that. Look at this. Wages explain only minimal fraction of price movement in recent years. You can see that here in the orange. This is how much wages are really contributing to inflation relative to the blue, which is how much wages used to contribute to inflation between the 70s and 1999. That's remarkable. So, how do we piece this together? Well, you have Barclays talking about bears becoming bulls because they're FOMOing, yet positioning still mostly cash and bonds. Are you kidding? And then Morgan Stanley's like, yo, this employment situation ain't that bad. And UniCredit, both of them are like, dude, even if private sector hiring goes down, the government step in, it'll be their turn. So you got buffers. The unemployment rate probably won't go as much up as much as people fear. And wages aren't actually driving inflation. This is remarkable. Like, I want bad news because I want to challenge my opinions. You know, I met with, who remembers when I did the interview with Gordon Johnson? This sucks, man. Anyway, I did the interview with Gordon Johnson and, you know, he's a Tesla bear. And, one of the reasons I wanted to do that, and you should look it up. Just type into YouTube, meet Kevin Gordon Johnson. It's really good. But one of the reasons I like putting myself in front of the bears is because I truly want to hear their argument. And I'm like, give me the best you got. You know, like, make a good presentation. Convince me to sell, is what I say. And I just haven't been convinced. And that's not saying I'm going to be right. But you know, I mean, obviously inflation could somehow magically skyrocket again, I guess, in America. It happened in England, which, you know, in the United Kingdom has. But, I don't know, short of that, it just doesn't seem that horrible. So, what else do we have here? Let's look at some of the commentary that you're getting. Somebody get Kevin the syrup. Yeah, that's probably a good idea. Maybe I'll go do that before the, what's it called, the GDP data comes out. Coinbase files motion to dismiss the SEC lawsuit. I mean, every attorney is always going to file a motion to dismiss pretty much against any claim. So, I mean, let me put it this way. I think any attorney is going to look at that and go, it means nothing. I'm not trying to take away optimism. Just trying to be realistic. If you're an attorney, somebody files a lawsuit against you, you're always going to file a motion to dismiss. And the judge would be like, yeah, we need to litigate. All right. Very well. Let's get ready for GDP data. And see how the market's moving on. So let's call that commentary. So somebody here says, if we don't value their stock price targets on stocks, why do we value their forecasts on the economy? No. I disagree with that. This isn't... You know, it's so funny. And I don't blame you. But I really think it's social media. Twitter is a massive culprit of this. To some extent, I think it's actually very horrible for society. Twitter makes society binary. You are either with us or you're against us. I hate that shit. I hate it so much. That's the worst part about Twitter, is that you're either with us or you're against us. That's not how society works. So, Gary Roberts, you bring up a very fair point. If we don't value the analyst price targets, why do we care about their forecasts of the economy? It's asking the wrong question, in my opinion. It's not whether we value the conclusion of what analysts say on the economy or on stocks. It's what reasons are they giving? If an analyst, whether you believe their price target or not, says, hey, we got to be careful about margin going to 18%. Here's why. We're looking at satellite data. We're looking at this, that, or whatever. We want to consider that data. If an analyst says, hey, you know, here's something that could actually buffer us not having negative unemployment or negative employment reports, and they're giving us perspective that otherwise we wouldn't have considered, well, that's how we learn, because now we could take that insight and study that for ourselves and then come up with our own conclusions. It's the same thing that I encourage on the channel here. I don't encourage that you listen to what I say and copy it exactly. You know, it's why I have courses on Zero to Millionaire Real Estate Investing, the stocks and psychology of money, and how to make more money and get SH19 done faster featuring AI. It's not to tell you exactly what to do. It's to give you the perspective and go, dang, I never thought about it that way before. And then that way you could come up with your own conclusions and hopefully be more successful because you're looking at things through a different lens. That's very powerful. So the binariness of what we're seeing in society is very dangerous. And I think that's actually what's polarizing our society more. Like, I'll tell you, you go on Twitter and it'll seem like the lefties are about to kill the right wingers and vice versa. Then when you talk to people in person and, you know, you talk to Trumpers, you talk to the DeSantis people, you talk to the Dems, you talk to the Libertarians, you talk to the further lefties or whatever. 85 to 90% of people are moderates at heart. They're like, mostly leave me alone, let people have their freedoms, and you know, let's do the best we can in society. That's like an overarching good, right? So it's the binariness is I think dangerous, and it's very unfortunate. So anyway, now we got GDP data. I'm gonna call that section Kevin on being binary. No, being non-binary. There we go. All right, here it comes. It's coming. The coupon code is expiring Friday, but GDP data is coming out. Oh, yes. 2% versus the 1.4%. Let's go, American economy again. Let's go. That could end up pushing some Fed pressure again there to continue, you know, with those hikes. But let's go. GDP annualized quarter over quarter coming in hot, baby. Hot, hot, hot. At 2%, expectation was 1.4%. Personal consumption, beat 4.2, expected 3.8. GDP price index. Let's go! It comes in weak. 4.1 versus 4.2. Let's go. Core PCE comes in weak also. 4.9. Expectation was 5. This is great because now you've got a hot GDP and even weaker GDP price data. That's awesome. That's really, really good. That's absolutely fantastic. Let's see what I love this guy. Let's see what he has to say about it. I want his reaction.
3.1 is not the lowest, though. 3.9 was the lowest after the 9% read, which was the highest in 81. That was in Q2 of 22. So progress being made, but obviously slow progress. If you look at the core personal consumption expenditure, quarter over quarter, that's 4.9%. That's 1/10 less than the 5% we were expecting. And how does that pan up to history? Well, second quarter of 21, not 22, is a high watermark. That was at 6%, the highest since 83. The lowest it's been was the fourth quarter of last year at 4.4 and now 4.9%. So we see that this is also very sticky. As a matter of fact, we've had several numbers.
He's such a bear. He's such a bear. Oh, it comes in soft. Oh, but it's still sticky. The survey was for it to be sticky. Oh, jobless claims just came in. 239 for jobs. Oh my gosh, these are good numbers too. What the heck? It's so good. 239 for initial jobless claims. The expectation was 265. That's a big miss. Stable on the revisions. And then for continuing claims, a miss again. 1.742. We were expecting 1.765. That's a 23,000 miss. This is amazing. So you mean to tell me this is supposed to be bearish? Like, listen, okay? People are so worried about recession and earnings recession. And you're going to come in here and be like, but inflation's still sticky. Suck it. If GDP is doing great, inflation is trending down, we're potentially not going to see a recession, knock on wood. We're not seeing this unemployment surge. This economy is just barreling through and forward. And so, okay, inflation's going to take some time to get down. What did Jay Powell tell us? He literally told us our expectation is inflation doesn't return to 2% until 2025. Bro straight up said it's going to take 2 years to get inflation down from today, which means like 3 years total, 3.25 years total to get inflation back down. That's crazy. And what? We're worried about another 25 or 50 basis points of hikes. You know, there was a fantastic piece I read the other day. I can't remember who put it together. I don't think it was Goldman. I can't remember who it was. But anyway, it was a fantastic piece. They talked about, here, I'm going to draw it for you. I don't know if you know what this is. If you're a math person, you know what this is. Ready for this? That's what they talked about. What does that mean? You should be screaming that at the top of your lungs right now. Kevin, that is a triangle. No, it's actually delta. So delta is the change. And what's the delta of rates that we've had over the last year? 500 basis points. What's the delta, the change of rates that we're expecting over the next 6 months? Like 50 bips. Almost worst case. Like, really? Really? Over the last year, we had 500 bips of rate hikes. And now people are bitching about, but what if the Fed does another 25 or 50? Bro, look at the delta. It's literally 1/10 as painful as what you had in the 2022 year. 1/10 as bad. It was actually a great piece. I wish I remembered where I found it, but it was a really great argument. It's like, how could you be bearish about rate hikes? Who cares? Just a slightly bit higher. Yes, yes, there are still bearish arguments. Kevin, what about the lagged effects? Okay, what about the potential earnings recession? Well, unfortunately, data is just not lining up with that idea. I mean, we'll see. Maybe Q2 earnings will suck. And you know what? If you're worried about Q2 earnings sucking, go buy yourself some hedges. I mean, look at how low volatility is right now. Here, look at the VIX. Look at the chart of the VIX. It literally broke my downtrend. It's so low. I have to go out to the week chart because it's been such weak paper hands over here. Look at that. There's my downtrend that I had. It broke that. So now I'm going to have to draw a new trend because there's no volatility. It's just been straight up, basically. I guess you could call it a channel to some extent. But it's kissing the bottom. This is crazy. I mean, really, this should be starting to converge down over here. Better off probably using a moving average. But point is, this is not a market that seems horribly scary in terms of volatility. So go ahead, buy your puts and buy your hedges. And in low vol environments, it's probably not great to sell options, but it depends on the individual security you're trying to hedge because they'll all have their own volatilities, especially going into earnings. But point is, this is fantastic. I mean, this is almost as good as the delicious, juicy lectures that are coming out for free over the weekend for existing course members with that awesome coupon expiration tomorrow at 11:59 p.m., next coupon will expire. It's going to be a big one. For a moment there, we were thinking about doing four phases of price increase. We're getting rid of all of that. Basically, that was just an excuse for me to get the lectures up slower. And I'm like, no, I got real work to do. We got a lot of work to do. We're getting these lectures up this weekend. And so we're just going to raise the price in total, large price increase tomorrow night. So anyway, put the pieces of the puzzle together here. If the unemployment data isn't coming in as bad as expected, and the GDP data is coming in strong, and the price data is coming in weak, isn't that literally the perfect case scenario? I mean, some people will call it the Goldilocks environment. And yeah, that doesn't mean we don't want to be careful and prudent, but I think we could cheer it. So let's look at some of the actual data. So, what do we have here? Real gross domestic product increased at an annual rate of 2% in the first quarter of 2023, according to the third estimate released by the BEA. In the fourth quarter, real GDP increased by 2.6%. Fantastic. The GDP estimate released today is based on more a complete source of data than were available for the second estimate issued last month. The second estimate was 1.3%, and we're revising that uply primarily to reflect revisions to exports and consumer spending that were partly offset by downward revisions in non-residential fixed investment and federal government spending. So non-residential fixed investment, think that's such a fancy word. Think about it like GigaPress, okay? When Elon buys a sexy... Sorry, that's like an airlock sound because I watched Passenger yesterday. First time ever watching Passenger. Lauren and I watched it together. Damn! If you haven't watched that movie yet, you gotta watch it. It's fantastic. Anyway, so the increase in, hashtag not sponsored, the increase in real GDP in the first quarter reflected increases in consumer spending. Okay, I swear that said esports, but it actually says exports. State and local government spending, federal government spending, non-residential, whatever. Okay, so there's a pretty chart. Compared to the fourth quarter, the deceleration in real GDP in the first quarter was primarily reflected a downturn in private inventory investment and a slowing of non-residential fixed, fine, offset by an acceleration of consumer spending. Fantastic. Personal income increased in the first quarter, up from the previous estimates. Great. Disposable income increased 12.9% in the first quarter. An upward revision of 26.4 billy from the previous. Personal savings were revised up. The personal savings rate, oh my God. Oh my gosh. What? The personal savings rate as a percentage of disposable income was 4.3%. Up from 0.1. Oh. Wow, that's remarkable. Wow. Okay, just a heads up, why I'm remarking about that is because this fell to like 2.4% for a while, in 2022, and it's starting to skyrocket again. This disposable income. This is fantastic. All right. Let's see here. So, real gross domestic income. It's just total for business and individuals. Decreased 1.8% in the first quarter. An upward revision of 0.5 percentage points from a previous estimate. All right, whatever. Profits, updates to GDP, GDP by industry. All right, let's see what we have over here. Q1. Government. See, look at that government pop. In 2022, Q2 and 3, government was pretty low. Government popped over here. And then private goods in Q1 was actually negative, a negative contributor. Wow. Okay, what do we have here? Contributions to percent change in real GDP by industry group. Okay, so these are contributions. On the right are positive, on the left is negative. Finance and insurance is the most negative, followed by manufacturing and wholesale trade and utilities. The best was actually retail trade, so y'all going to the mall and buying stuff. Healthcare, agricultural, forestry, and hunting. Ooh. And fishing. Real estate, rental and leasing, accommodation, travel, arts and entertainment. All the fun stuff is up there. I want to go fishing again. It's been a while. I don't know, bears. What do you have to say this time? It's just, like, if you're bear, it's okay. We can still be friends. We can still, you know, drink water together at the bar. Or you know, coffee at the coffee shop, right? So, but this is crazy. Like, all of us should be looking at this going, this is a blowout. This data is a blowout. Expected 1.4, we got 2.0 on GDP. And then price is coming. Remember, like, what was it? 10 minutes ago or whatever? Or I think it was at the beginning of the live stream. I'm like, okay, the best we can hope for is a GDP beat and a miss on inflation. But, you know, the world can't be perfect. Let's just hope for the best. And that's literally what we got. Where's the button?
Gain the lead.
Yeah. Oh, man. Anyway. All right. It's fantastic. Let's move on to, I don't know, something else. Before more people get pissed off at me again. So we'll go over here.
I definitely don't want to cut back here, you know?
Yes. It is one you think about. You know, I'll just put in a plug for the company I work for in Farger. You know, part of what we're trying to do with electric air taxis, how do we de-risk? How do we decongest? You mentioned road traffic. I mean, the road traffic is back with the vengeance as well. So this is a space that will continually evolve. And this is truly the role that Archer and other aviation and electric air taxis can play a role in. But overarchingly, really as a nation, we want to make sure that we've got the best national aerospace ecosystem in the world. And that means having that level of funding, having that strong cooperation, collaboration with the industry and with the FAA, and really holding each other to a high degree of accountability so to make sure we get this right. This is really what, you know, the public should have a right to expect.
Very good. All right, Billy Nolen, thank you. And you know what? A pilot's perspective, anything else, anyone who hasn't done that, I don't think they really can talk as intelligently about this. But we appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Joe. Appreciate it.
All right.
Coming up, venture capitalist and former Goldman Sachs asset management chairman Sheila Patel joins us for a market conversation you will not want to miss. And a reminder, you can always check us out using the CNBC app.
Boring. You should be pitching the coupon code expiring tomorrow, not this CNBC app. What is this, your show? My show. All right. Let's see if Bloomberg's awake. Anyway, I want to talk about the bank stress tests as well in just a moment. We'll talk about that. We got some other pieces to cover as well. Interesting. It would appear Bloomberg is not with us today. Really? What did I do wrong? I screwed it up. Fine. whatever. All right. So let's take a preview peek here. What do we got? How did the market react to that data? That would be kind of interesting to see. QQQ. Not like the way you would expect. That was freaking awesome. What is this garbage? It's a mess. That's not what I want to see. Take this mess and go somewhere else. Here, we'll go over here. What is this? No activity? Come on, wake up. This is nonsense. How about the SPY? What is this crap? This is boring. We'll look at Bitcoin. There we go. See, look, it went up. I'm just kidding. That's the day chart. Nobody cared. It's insane. The data was so good. Whatever. Bloomberg sucks anyway, says someone. Yeah, you'll figure out what's wrong with that, though. Anyway. All right. So what are the losers doing today? Let's see here. Let's go to the pre-market. And the losers, Lordstown Motors. Careful memeing this stuff. Like, I know people try to, like, YOLO it on these bankrupt stocks. I'm just like, oh, my God. Just, like, literally, like, jumping on minefields. Whatever. Nextdoor. That's, like, the most toxic platform next to Twitter. Open Doors at $4. Man. I remember talking about this thing. We talk about it so much. But even after their earnings, they went to, like, 180. I'm like, man, this thing's probably going to run to, like, $2 or $3. I didn't expect it to go to $4. That's crazy. Well, it's got some, like, now it's getting ridiculous again. Lemonade back to $17.50. Wow. Yeah, that's been a... I wonder how AI is really going to... like, AI and the chatbot at Lemonade was the big, like, feature of theirs. Like, oh, yeah, well, we have AI. Before AI was, you know, cool. All right, they're back. Let's see what they have to say now.
Got the S&P up about 13, NASDAQ up 42. Energy, talked to Jeff Curry earlier. He says we're going higher at some point, but still below 70 on WTI. And a good session so far. It's been a good week or so for Bitcoin and crypto, up another 2% at 1,700.
The Fed says all 23 of U.S. banks included in its annual stress test exercise weathered a severe recession scenario while continuing to lend to consumers and businesses. The banks had $541 billion in projected losses, but were able to maintain minimum capital levels. However, this year's tests were devised before the recent banking crisis sparked by the collapse of Silicon Valley Bank. Charles Schwab performed best in this exercise. The test results give banks the green light for another round of capital of dividends and buybacks, though the uncertain economy may curb shareholder returns in the short run.
The three companies set to make their Wall Street debut today. Savers Value Village, that's the largest for-profit thrift store operator in the U.S. and Canada, priced at $18 a share. That's above the estimated range. Kodiak Gas Services, priced at $16 a share. That's below a prior range. And Fidelis Insurance, priced at $14 a share. That was below its proposed range. Coming up, some top stocks on the move ahead of the opening bell on Wall Street.
Boring.
Stay tuned. And you're watching Squawk Box, starring.
That's all you have? Y'all literally just went on a commercial. You came back for a minute to read me what oil did. And then you dipped out again. What is this? Y'all are bored. That's what it is. You know, what I think is remarkable is that J-Pow is like, we're going to get two or more rate hikes. And then people were fighting about whether or not he actually said two or more, which he did. I played it back too. The market just didn't care. It was kind of incredible. Oh, let's look at 5-year break even. And the world interest rate probability. I love that. Margin Call 911 says, the experts say there will be a downturn in the second half. Yeah, oops. You know what I think is funny is, I saw this TikTok yesterday. If you've ever done construction, you know you have to like call a certain number. Depending on where you is. I it might be 811 everywhere. But anyway, you call a number and you call them and you're like, hey, I'm going to dig. I did this, I've done this actually many times on properties before when you dig footings for a foundation or, you know, I mean, my first house I ever bought, I called them. They just come out and they basically spray paint where all the utility lines are so you don't cut them. Anyway, this TikTok was hilarious. And I don't know why your name kind of reminds me of it. But here, hold on a sec. I don't think, is there an easy way for me to do this? I don't know if I'm going to get the audio. Screw it. We'll just do it the old-fashioned way. So this guy pumping gas. You don't really have to see him. Just listen to what he says. It's kind of funny. Mind if we ask you a quick question? All right, here we go.
Question? Sure, go ahead. What you got? We're doing a survey, and we're asking people, what would you do if somebody broke into your house with the intentions to rob and harm your family?
Oh, I'd call
811. 811? You mean 911?
No. 811, because I'm going to need to know where to dig a hole.
I don't know why. I thought that was great. Dig alert. Yeah, there you go. So anyway, I don't know why your name reminded me of that, but I thought it was funny. Okay. 5-year break even, 2.17, stuck in the muds. That's why, you know, we're getting this talk about pushing rates. You know, another 25, 50 bips. The expectation for rate hikes isn't for two hikes at all right now, although it's almost certainly priced in, unless we get a big miss on CPI. Unless we get a big miss on CPI, we're pricing in a 79.4% chance of a 25 basis point hike on July 26th. Of course, we'll be getting CPI data on the 12th of July, and that'll be year-over-year data going back to June of last year when I was covering CPI from a beach in Düsseldorf without my shirt. That was fun. We did that live. The fact that I actually had internet to pull that one off on the beach at a lake, because it's like, what beach is there in Düsseldorf? It's like landlocked. Anyway, that was cool. So, then you had, you've got only about a 19% chance right now of a double basis point hike by, or a double hike by September. And you're looking at about a 30% chance of a double hike by November. And by December, that goes down to about 24%. If we actually look at the WIRP, which is the World Interest Rate Probability Chart, you get a funny little curve. We can look at some updates over here. Let's see here. All right. What have we here? What does the WIRP say? Well, let's get rid of that fundamental analysis from yesterday. Clean up the desktop, Kevin. All right. Here we go. So what is this? Implied overnight, whatever. Where's a peak? Peak's over here, not in Mozambique, just the peak on the chart. That makes no sense. Anyway, it's somewhere around November of 2023. You're still only pricing in like five, what is that? Pricing maybe 5.32 or something like that. I'll get the exact number in just a moment. And, you know, we are right now at about, you'd probably put us right about here is where we sit right now, which means you're really not pricing in cuts until over here. March, June, you're definitely pricing in a couple cuts by then. And then by the end of 2024, you're really pricing in a cut and a half. That could all get delayed. It got delayed a lot already. And as they delayed it, what happened to the stock market? Stock market just went up.
We count everything that is AI as AI. If their teams are picking enterprise software, it's probably using AI. There are a lot of indirect investments in AI, and I think that's actually generating some momentum in sectors that aren't getting credit for it. So right now, if you look at the rally we've seen over the past few months in the S&P, it's so tech-driven, AI-driven. But actually, industrials and a lot of other industries, healthcare, will be hugely impacted, potentially even bigger than tech itself by AI.
Do you feel like this market at the levels we're currently trading at is more vulnerable or less vulnerable because of the outsized leadership we've had in a handful of tech stocks?
Well, I would say, you know, coming from my history at Goldman and on trading floor, my origins. I always get a little worried when you have a dominant sector to this degree. I mean, the rally in tech is larger than the entire market cap of industrials. That's a little off. All right, so something has to give. I think broadening would obviously be more pleasurable for everybody than seeing a huge pullback, but that singular focus is maybe, again, a bit of a misguided approach to how AI can actually impact the markets overall.
How is your firm looking at AI? You were mentioning some of the ways that we're maybe not thinking of AI in other industries. So is it just sort of like the obvious ChatGPT, OpenAI kind of companies, or is it other sort of ancillary companies?
It is ancillary companies. It is how can AI help traditional industries, help other segments? You know, our strategic partner is BCG. They make a business of advising the biggest multi.
Sorry, I'm bored by this.
Every area. Take pharma. If you look at one of our portfolio companies, Atomwise, they're using AI to address small molecule drug discovery. They've just inked a great deal with Sanofi because of that ability of AI to potentially help problems that we have in drug discovery for very difficult diseases and very difficult solutions to find. That's just one example, and there are numerous examples like that.
Young companies, you know, in an environment where interest rates are higher and the economy might soften, it might be a challenging environment, but you're looking at an area that's very hot. So how do those sort of two opposing factors play out when it comes to valuations that you're finding?
Well, it's been a bit of a trifecta, right? Mm-hmm. First of all, you had non-traditional investors show up in venture in the last 5 years. That's been huge. And so any number of potentially great ideas have been funded. They're now at their lowest level investment in 5 years. IPOs, as you were reporting earlier, lowest number in 10 years. Then you get to venture itself, and it's been a tough fundraising environment for venture and tough to see next rounds. And so, you know, for us, we look at it and we say, who can we help that has the runway and have the ideas that can help new industries in the future?
I would think that based on what we're seeing in the market, I mean, it does seem like there are pockets of speculation going on, that there's some willingness to take on risk, whether it be in the new IPOs that we're seeing being priced today, for it to be priced today. Some individual stocks that have just exhibited huge runs, like a Carvana, which is up 400%. And then also the AI sort of...
You gotta be careful measuring these percentages from, like, the bottom, man.
From your perspective, doesn't look like it's very robust.
Well, you know, I think it's been interesting, the shift from public to private. Mm-hmm. You're seeing companies stay private longer, and you're seeing maybe a sentiment that that's a good thing because it enables them to develop their business in a different way versus the day-to-day pressures that you get if you're a public company. And I think that's probably true. So that actually gives me some hope from that speculation perspective. I think the real concern on the speculation part is for those public markets and that concentration maybe in a few sectors that make it a little tough to keep a rally going.
Novices. When did you leave Goldman, Sheila?
I left Goldman in 2021. We're almost exactly at 2 years since I resigned from being chairman and management.
Okay, whatever. Chairman. Wouldn't it be chairwoman? Chairman. Chairwoman. Chairperson? I can't keep up anymore. It's the California. I don't know. It's alright. Anyway. All right, let's talk. I finally found you. What's that from? Oh, from Grammar Nazi. That's right. I have finally found you. Anyway, all right. I have finally found the bear piece that I wanted to talk about today. So let me write this down. OMG, the bears. All right. So you all know I've been looking for a bear piece to cover, and I have finally found one. Of course, it is from none other than T.S. Lombard. T.S. Lombard is that stands for bear. they're the ones who are like, we're super bearish, but we're going to actually go neutral equities and increase our equities allocation because we don't want to miss out. Okay, all right. Anyway, what could they possibly argue as bearish? Oh, well, of course, China invading Taiwan. keep an eye on Taiwan's own domestic boiling point. As with Kyiv, 2014, Taiwan, a top geopolitical flashpoint, is inching towards a crossroads set to be catalyst by next January's presidential race. Oh no, oh no, get ready for more clickbait drama in the stock market. Folks, we have a catalyst. January's election. It's going to be huge in Taiwan. And then it'll be followed by our own election. Even if a pro-China candidate wins, Beijing's red lines will still be tested by the island's surging sense of national identity. You know, we were studying some of Xi Jinping's speeches 2 days ago when we were talking about this. And just to summarize some of the principles, the principles really are, of course, promoting common prosperity for Chinese, also with a sense of capitalism, something we haven't seen historically. But when it comes to Taiwan, China is at least open to the idea, which I think is a very reasonable conclusion, but China is open to the idea of Taiwan being a region much like, they call them semi-autonomous regions, much like Macau or Hong Kong, where Hong Kong is generally deemed capitalistic and largely separated from the Chinese Communist Party, but still part of China. It's a semi-autonomous region. It's like, kind of like almost like a territory. There's no real easy comparison to the United States. But anyway, to me, China isn't gearing up for, like, let's go invade Taiwan. But the bears will continue to yap about that as a potential. So anyway, let's see here. Oh, of course. Of course. Now that the bear narrative is fading away, what does T.S. Lombard say? Markets are not yet pricing in vital and rising Taiwan-related risks for global tech supply, like a Chinese blockade on a 1 to 3 year view. All right. Taiwan, how dare the ships block us? Would have no other way to get the chips out of Taiwan if we can't bring them out on a ship. Maybe we'll hire OSHA. Not too soon. Anyway, we'll fly them. Okay, Taiwan, home to over 90% of advanced chip output. This, by the way, is why we like seeing Intel and Taiwan Semiconductors manufacturing or creating plants in Arizona for TSMC, and then like multiple more plants around the world for Intel, whether that's Germany or Israel or Ohio. Anyway, Taiwan currently home to 90% of advanced chip output. That will change over the next few years. That'll substantially change. And 60% of the entire semiconductor value supply chain is a geopolitical flashpoint without parallel, thanks to, you know, this fear about China. So what do they say here? While the electoral outcome, given a tight three-way race, is highly uncertain and crucially binary for geopolitical risk implications, it's, what is this binaryism? Anyway, a clear and present danger lies ahead. Is it lies ahead or lay ahead? I don't know. No matter who wins, even though it supports the current status quo, that is this de facto independence without formal declaration, Beijing's own red lines will be visibly tested by Taiwan's growing and vibrant sense of national identity. After 8 years in power, the U.S.-leaning Nationalist Party, the DPP, who cannot run for re-election, you know, their existing president, is under pressure. The economic downturn coincides with the election and would typically award victory to the opposition party, which could be the Chinese party. Ooh. All right. Triumph for the incumbent of DPP is likely to exacerbate tensions. So if the DPP candidate wins, what if there's a blockade? Or you know, what if China invades, basically? Victory for the China-friendly opposition, KMT or TPP candidates, for some combination, would ease cross-strait tensions and could temporarily reduce the regional friction and geopolitical risk while improving cross-strait ties. It's interesting. I would have almost expected, as a bear, them to go from both angles of bearishness and basically say, if the pro-American one wins, blockade, if the Chinese one wins, finish the takeover. All right. What else here? The rub for investors is that even this, quote, less risky latter outcome, although likely to aid in lowering geopolitical tensions, will do little to reduce the core risk of some accident leading to a military escalation, leading to or culminating in a Chinese blockade. And that's always what it goes to. And potentially a full-scale invasion, maybe make a more realistic version of a full-scale invasion. Add to this Taiwan's lively, freewheeling society that ranks today among Asia's most progressive populations, with three-quarters of those polled holding unfavorable views of the CCP. Well, how's the CCP candidate going to win then if three-quarters of them, of the folks in Taiwan, hold unfavorable views of the CCP? Anyway. Here, the case of what happened in Ukraine 2013-14 serves as a cautionary tale. But this is not Putin we're dealing with here. I feel like the Chinese are a little more level-headed. As much as I have my criticisms, I actually don't think Xi Jinping is a loose cannon like the loose cannon of Vladimir Putin. You know, I made a great video, by the way, summarizing Wagner yesterday. Really worth watching. I don't think it was a good summary. Anyway, in that Ukrainian case, the Ukrainian president at that time was facing a re-election 1 year down the road, and decided to sign a political and economic agreement with the EU that was broadly popular and would have led to a useful pre-election set of financial support from the EU. But then, under Russian pressure, abruptly changed course along with money from Moscow. Simultaneously, mass protests erupted, ending in bloodshed in Kyiv and the downfall of the president, and the rest is history. In other words, anything can happen, and T.S. Lombard is like, you know, remember, we're bears, and now we're really grasping at straws here to keep you bearish, because that's our job. We have to remind you about Taiwan. All right, this is a little boring. So they call it the cross-strait powder keg. All right. Well, at least that powder keg is an opportunity to remind you about the courses on building your wealth link down below, because there's a massive coupon expiration tomorrow. And new lectures coming out on Sunday. It's going to be really awesome. So make sure you're part of it, because all the existing course members get that stuff for free. And you should be part of it too. So what else do we have? We have, let's see how the pre-market is doing. We have, the NASDAQ's given up almost all of its gains. What is this? Such great numbers this morning. It's just trading, man. It's just trading, okay? Anyway. NASDAQ's only up 6 basis points. S&P's up 9 basis points. Dow's up 11 basis points. Tesla's up 120 basis points. What else? Tech IPO drought reaches 18 months. Okay, yeah. Who wants to IPO in this environment? Wagner forces will no longer fight in Ukraine. Prigozhin deal terms may still be under discussion. Nice. Aspartame may cause cancer. Yeah, we've known that for, like, I feel like decades. Artificial sweeteners, one of them. It's probably all of them, but who knows. Anyway, not a loose cannon concerning military action, but is against his own populace and random industries, says Opsar. Ooh. All right, that's all I got for now. I'm going to go make some more coffee, and I'll see you all soon in the Course Member Live for those of you who are part of it. Thanks for being here. Another Meet Kevin Report, and we'll see you again tomorrow. Goodbye.